All righty, let's pick it up then on page 53. Session 7 starts on page 53 of your workbook. So let's review quickly where we've been. Our first few weeks, our first month or so, was in the biblical introduction to all this, to the modern state of Israel, the spiritual war, material that you really should master. And if you master it, you'll understand the Bible better, and you'll understand what's going on in the Middle East and today. So that we've passed through the biblical introduction. Then we took a look at some of the background of the modern state, the historical survey of the period from 66 AD to 1839 AD. We began with the Roman period, when Jerusalem was conquered by the Romans in 70 AD. And then Hadrian wanted to rebuild it as a Roman city. He did so and called it Aelia Capitolina. And we took a look at how it was designed around typical Roman lines with a cardo running down the middle of it. And if you go to Israel today, if you go to Jerusalem today, you can see remnants of the cardo. Here is that Roman level paving stones with the columns that were part of the cardo set back up in place. They had been, of course, knocked over, and so archaeologists have all set them back up in place. So you can see the cardo today, the remnants of the cardo today. We also learned that the Roman Empire extended from Mesopotamia all the way over to Spain, and that it eventually divided in the middle into the Eastern Roman Empire with its capital at Byzantium and the Western Roman Empire with its capital at Rome. And what I wanted to point out is that the little province of Israel was simply a little speck in the eastern end of the Eastern Roman Empire. Again, it wasn't an independent nation. It was not an independent nation under the Romans. Israel was not an independent nation under the Byzantines during the Byzantine era. Just a province in a larger conquered area. Then we looked at the Arab time period and the Arab advance into Israel in 634. The armies of Islam entered Israel in this time, and for the first time of history, a large population of Muslims and Arab Muslims entered into Israel. And the Arab advance didn't stop with Israel, but the Muslim advance went into the Middle East, into the Persian Empire, and they conquered the top of Africa, North Africa, and up into Spain. Up in Spain, they were stopped by Charles Martel of the Franks, or the French border. And in the Middle East, they were stopped at what we call Turkey today by the Byzantines. So they did not advance into the Byzantine era empire at that time. Well, then we took a look at Israel during the Crusader period. During the Crusader period, the territory we're looking at is called the Kingdom of Jerusalem. It was just a short period of time that the Crusaders dominated this territory. And again, it was not an independent kingdom. Just another province with the Seljuk Empire on the east, the Fatimid Caliphate on the south, the county of Tripoli to the north. Well, after the Crusader Kingdom came the Ottoman Empire. By the 14th century, the Ottoman Empire had expanded to that little red area up there in Turkey. But by the 17th century, the Ottoman Empire was at its peak, moving into Europe, into the Far East, and all across Northern Africa. Well, the Ottoman Empire, in the Ottoman Empire, again, Israel is just a small province in the Ottoman Empire. The Ottoman Empire then decayed from within, and by 1914, it consisted of Turkey and the Arabian Peninsula, and then by 1923, it was basically just down to Turkey with the end of World War I. And so there's a quick overview of the major periods from 66 AD to 1839. My point is that the territory we call Israel today never was an independent country. It was always a province of some other, under the domination of some other conqueror. The area we call Israel today never had an independent national existence until the Jewish people returned. Okay, well, this, all this 2,000 years, It was just a province. Now that brings us to point three in your outline, the end of the exile, 1839 to 1947. Now we get into the modern Zionist movement proper. So page 53. Yeah, way back at the beginning of your notebook. Yeah, beginning of your notebook. All right, when we looked at session number one, way back when, we looked at this DVD and we watched program one, The Assignment. The DVD is Against All Odds, Israel Survives, and we'll watch some more programs from this DVD. But in program one, The Assignment, Michael Greenspan asked 10 questions. So let's review those questions real quick. First of all, how did the Jewish people manage to survive 2,000 years of exile? Two, how did we manage to build a nation out of almost nothing? Three, how did Israel manage to win the 1948 war? That should not have happened. Neither should we have survived 1973. In 1973, the Yom Kippur War, why did President Nixon, who was considered by many to be devoutly anti-Semitic, order the biggest arms lift since World War II and save Israel? Good question. Five, why were no Israelis killed by Saddam Hussein's Scud missiles during the Gulf War? Six, why are the outcomes of Israel's war so unique? You know, the war colleges will not study them because they should not have. Israel should not have won the wars. Seven, how did Hebrew become the only dead language in history to become revived? We're going to look at that in just a few minutes. Eight, after 2,000 years, why would millions of people from around the world leave their homes and move to a desert wasteland and build new lives for themselves? How can that be explained? Nine, how did these people turn a land that was more than 80% desert into one of the largest food and flour exporters in the world? And number 10, why do incredible achievements in science, medicine, and new technologies happen here in greater concentration than anywhere else? Well, you know, I've got an 11th question for you. And that 11th question came from this article in Israel National News just back in January, January 24th. Here's how the article read. Recent study of National Power Index ranks Israel 10th. Research is a composite index of factors including military and economic capability. So this National Power Index rates all countries on something like 14 different indexes. And so here is the rating of the countries by the National Power Index. The 10 most powerful nations in the world in order: the United States, China, Russia, France, Japan, the United Kingdom, Germany, India, Canada, and Israel. Tiny little Israel. Can you believe that? So here's question number 11. How did this tiny, itsy bitsy, teeny weeny little nation, surrounded by implacable enemies with limited natural resources, manage to become the 10th most powerful nation in the world in only 66 years? 66 years, you guys. You know, does that make sense? Well, we're going to answer all those questions now. We're getting into the history of the modern state. By the time we get done with this course, you will know the answer to all those questions. You will know the answer. Yes?
Do we have
those questions somewhere? Yes. They're a handout. They're a handout. I gave you that handout. It's probably the first handout I gave you. You guys wanted it. No, not today. Very first, the second session. It's way back. It's way back at the beginning. Page 8A. Page 8A. You want number 11 as well. All right. I'll make a slide for you. You're not the only person that wants it, believe me. I'll make another slide. All righty. So, we will be looking at the people God used. We'll be looking at the circumstances God orchestrated to create the modern state of Israel. So let's dive into this now. So page 53 at the top. 1839. We begin in Belgrade. It used to be called Belgrade, Yugoslavia, with an Orthodox rabbi named Judah Alkali. Here is the venerable rabbi, Judah Alkali. Judah Alkali was born toward the end of the 18th century. He was an obscure preacher in the little Sephardic community of Semlin near Belgrade. Now, Belgrade is in modern Serbia today, no longer called Yugoslavia, but Serbia. So on the left, you can see a map of Europe, and of course, the red area there is Serbia. And on the right, within Serbia, the city of Belgrade. So within, somewhere near Belgrade is that little town of Semlin. So this is where Rabbi Alkali came from in Eastern Europe. Now in 1839, he astounded his congregants by publishing a Ladino Hebrew textbook. Now what's that word, Bob? Ladino. Well, Ladino is a Spanish Hebrew hybrid language, like Yiddish. Yiddish is a German Hebrew hybrid language that we spoke in Eastern Europe. Well, the Sephardic Jewry in Spain and Northern Africa spoke Ladino. So apparently he had a lot of Ladino speakers in his congregation, even though it was there in Eastern Europe. See, he published a Ladino Hebrew textbook called Darche Noam, Pleasant Paths. In the introduction, he alluded to the need of establishing Jewish colonies in the Holy Land as a necessary prelude, that's a key word, prelude to the redemption. Now in his later writings, the best is Shema Yisrael, Hear O Israel, Alkali noted that self-effort taken by the Jews toward establishing the redemption was justified by the proof texts of tradition. So he saw this in the traditions of the rabbis. Now note the next sentence. If you're following along, highlight it. Highlight it, okay? In other words, Jews could work for the establishing of the redemption. They didn't have to wait for the coming of the Messiah. So he interpreted the traditions to say, we don't have to wait for the Messianic person. This is a radical shift, especially in Eastern European Jewish thinking. We don't have to wait, okay? That would shock his congregation. Of course it would. Now, the dominant view in Jewish life at this time was the view that the Messiah had to come first, before Israel could return to the land. Now, in 1840, a significant event occurred in Damascus that influenced his thinking very, very deeply. So we're at 1840, the Damascus blood libel, middle of page 53. All right, what is the Damascus blood libel? Here is a little article in Wikipedia that summarizes it quickly. The Damascus affair was an 1840 incident in which the accusation of ritual murder was brought against members of the Jewish community of Damascus. And yes, it is the same Damascus that we read about in the newspaper today due to the Civil War. It's the same Damascus Paul was going to when he came face to face with the Messiah. It's the same Damascus in the Old Testament. It's one of the oldest cities in the world. Okay? A pogrom. Pogrom. Yes, that's basically what happened. All right, let's go on. Whoops, did I read all of that? Yes. Eight notable Jews of Damascus were falsely accused of murdering a Christian monk, imprisoned, and tortured. Several of the imprisoned died of torture, and another was forced to convert to Islam. In addition, the Muslim population of Damascus fell upon the Jewish synagogue in the suburb of Yobar, pillaged it, and destroyed the scrolls of the law. Negotiations in Alexandria, that would be Egypt, a little bit to the west. Negotiations in Alexandria, Egypt, secured the unconditional release and recognition of innocence of the 9 prisoners still remaining alive, out of 13. In a new and groundbreaking effort, now this is another switch too, the American Jewish community of 15,000, well that's not very many Jews, but the American Jewish community of 15,000 protested in 6 American cities on behalf of their Syrian brethren. For the first time in American Jewish life, Jews organized themselves politically to help diaspora Jewry in distress. So that's another significant event from 1840. So in 1840, the efforts of the influential Western Jews achieved the release of several unfortunate Jewish people imprisoned in Damascus on the blood libel charges. Now, before we go any farther, let me explain to you the blood libel. And again, it comes from Wikipedia. This is as good an explanation as any. Blood libel, also called blood accusation, is a false accusation or claim that Jews kidnap and murder the children of Christians to use their blood as part of their religious rituals during Jewish holidays. And most prominently, this comes out during Passover, that the Jewish community will steal a Christian kid, bleed him dry, or her dry, and mix the blood in to make the matzah. Okay, isn't that kind of disgusting? It's still around today. You would think in the modern world the blood libel would have disappeared. Now, every Passover you hear about it. It's still going around today. So, that's what the blood libel is all about. Now, alkali detected in this miracle of vigorous secular action, a precedent for the future stages of the redemption of Palestine. Now, in 1843, he wrote a booklet entitled Minchat Yehuda, Offering of Judah, and here's what he said in this booklet. It is written in the Bible, Return, O Lord, unto the tens of thousands of the families of Israel. But upon what should the divine presence rest? On sticks and stones? You know, he's saying, hey, there's no Jewish people, hardly any Jewish people in the land. Is the divine presence going to come down on dirt and rocks? No, it's going to come down on people. So what does that mean? Therefore, as the initial stage of the redemption of our souls, we must cause at least 22,000 to return to the Holy Land. Now, where he got that number, 22,000, I don't know. But that's his calculations. This is the necessary precondition for a descent of the divine presence among us. Afterward, he will grant us and all Israel additional signs of his favor. So that was his point of view. We need to get Jewish people into the land so the divine presence can descend upon us. Now, during the remaining 35 years of his life, Alkali published his ideas extensively. And in the end, he settled in Israel, in Palestine, as an example to others. Now, before his death in 1878, this energetic rabbi managed to organize a small group of followers. And listen to who one of the followers is. One of the disciples was Simon Loeb Herzl, the grandfather of Theodore Herzl, who we'll talk about extensively as we get through the course. So notice how connections begin. God's little connections. Here we have the grandfather of Theodore Herzl is now a budding Zionist. 1843, page 54. Alkali's views were paralleled to a remarkable degree by a contemporary and colleague, the Orthodox rabbi Zvi Hirsch Kalischer. And here's a picture of Rabbi Kalischer. And you have a picture of him in your notebook. Now, Kalischer served a large congregation of Polish-speaking in the Polish-speaking city of Thorn, East Prussia. Now, Prussia doesn't exist today, but here is an older map of Europe. And here in northern Europe, you can see Prussia inside the red circle there, Sweden, across the Baltic Sea to the north, etc., Denmark. So there's Prussia. This is East Prussia. And in East Prussia is the little city of Thorn. At least it was called Thorn there. The name has changed today. Now, this is all Poland today. This is all the nation of Poland today, pretty much. So again, Eastern Europe. Another rabbi in Eastern Europe begins this adventure called Zionism. Now, Kalischer enjoyed a rather substantial following. And as a result, he was given an immediate and respectful hearing. Now, in 1843, he published his views in a two-volume work entitled Emuna Yeshara, An Honest Faith. In 1862, he completed his presentation in a final volume, Drishat Zion, Search for Zion. Now, three principal ideas were developed in these volumes. Number one, the salvation of the Jews, as foretold by the prophets, could take place through natural means, that by self-help and did not require the advent of the Messiah. Okay, sounds just like Rabbi Alkali, doesn't he? Two, colonization of Palestine should be launched without delay. hey, there's no reason to beat around the bush. Let's do it, you guys, now. Three, the revival of sacrifices in the Holy Land was permissible. Here's what he wrote. Now, Rabbi Alkali said he found justification for his views in tradition. What does Kalischer say? Pay no heed to the traditional view that the Messiah will suddenly loose a blast on the great shofar and cause all the inhabitants of the earth to tremble. So he said, reject tradition. Alkali said, embrace tradition. But they came up with the same idea. We can go ahead and begin to restore Israel. On the contrary, the redemption will begin with the generation of support among philanthropists and with the gaining of the consent of the nations to the gathering of the scattered of Israel into the Holy Land. So his point is that when many pious and learned Jews volunteered to live in Jerusalem, then the Creator would hearken to our prayers and he would speed the day of redemption. So this is a paradigm shift in Jewish thinking. This is a sea change in Jewish thinking. We can go ahead and go back to Israel without waiting for the Messiah. Now, in addition, he urged four more steps to be taken. He was a very practical and really a pretty sharp guy. Listen to these four steps. First of all, the formation of a society of rich Jews to undertake the colonization of Zion. In other words, we need money. So you rich dudes, get on the bandwagon here. We need money to do this. Number two, settlement by Jews of all backgrounds on the soil of the Holy Land. So we need people to go back there, very practical. Notice number three, the training of young Jews in what? Self-defense. Yeah, he was thinking ahead, wasn't he? He was very wise, a very necessary skill, self-defense. And fourth, the establishment of an agricultural school in the land of Israel where Jews might learn farming and other practical subjects. You see, in Europe, we were denied ownership of the land. And so we had to turn to other trades to make make a living. We had to turn to banking and lending and diamonds and crafts. We weren't farmers. We weren't allowed to be farmers. And so he says here, hey, if we're going to go back to Israel, we need agricultural skills. So again, this guy, Sechel, he had some brains and common sense. Now, Kalischer's notion of practical messianism was appealing enough to win over a small but influential group of contemporaries who joined him in founding a society for the colonization of the land of Israel. So, Zionism is off the launching pad. All right, bottom of page 54. During this time, Jews were filtering back into the Holy Land, just a little bit here and a little bit there. And in 1856, the Jewish population was around 17,000, not very many. Most of these newcomers were devoutly religious, and as a result, more than one-third chose to settle in Jerusalem. And the name attached to them was Hayishuv Hayashan, the old settlement. Their mission was the sacred mission. See, they considered a sacred mission of living, worshiping, and dying on the holy soil, and especially in the holy city of Jerusalem. All right, top of page 55, Chalukah. Now, few of the Jews in Jerusalem or elsewhere in Israel were self-supporting. They depended heavily upon the charitable generosity of the Jews abroad. Now, by the 1860s, a systematic collection and distribution of these gifts amounted to half the income of the Jerusalem Jews and a third of the income for the rest of Palestine Jewry. And this system of charity was known as Chalukah, division. Now, also during this time, there was a tremendous national awakening sweeping Europe. And Rabbi Kalischer noted it, and he wrote in one of his articles, "All the other peoples have striven only for the sake of their own national honor. How much more?" See, there's good Jewish thinking there, from a Kolbe Homer argument, you know, from the light to the heavy. "How much more should we exert ourselves, for our duty is to labor for the glory of God, who chose Zion, not just for our own national honor, but for the honor of God." So he had a very, very spiritual emphasis to his desire to see Jews come back to the Holy Land. Now, one of the most original responses to this national awakening in the 19th century was the response of Moses Hess, 1862, middle of page 55. By the way, what was going on in 1862 in the USA? Civil War was just beginning. Abraham Lincoln was the president, okay? I'm going to try and bring in those little tidbits about what was happening here so you guys can kind of relate to where, what's going on over in Israel.
Did Abraham Lincoln like the Jews?
That I can't answer. You'll have to go to Wikipedia or something. Or you'll have to Google Abraham Lincoln and anti-Semitism and see what happens. Can't answer that one. All right, Moses Hess was the son of an Orthodox Jewish family in Bonn, Germany. So here's a portrait of Moses Hess. Again, a bright young man. And he was born in Bonn, Germany. Here is a modern map of Germany in the city of Bonn, located here in western Germany. So he was in Europe, not Eastern Europe, but Central Europe. Now, in 1857, the writings of Rabbi Kalischer were drawn to his notice. So see the connection here? Rabbi Kalischer and now Moses Hess. And they impelled Hess to begin a systematic study of Jewish history. The result was Hess's second book called Rome and Jerusalem, published in 1862. And by the way, if you're interested in reading it, it is still available on Amazon.com. You can get it. Here's the picture on Amazon, Rome and Jerusalem by Moses Hess. So if you're interested, there it is. Now in the book, he asserted that return to the land of Israel was indispensable if the Jews were to shed their function as an historical anomaly, an historical abnormality, a social parasite in the lands of other peoples. Only on ancestral soil could Jewish labor find it possible to organize on correct socialist principles. So he was a very socialist-oriented Jewish man. Hess issued the warning that a national homeland offered the Jews their last and best chance for self-transformation into a normal people. We would be freed from the vulnerable phantom status that historically had provoked anti-Semitism. So his motivation for the modern state of Israel was to avoid anti-Semitism. Now, Rome and Jerusalem ignited no fires in the Jewish world, not in 1862. Only 200 copies of the book were sold in 5 years. Hess's writings carried a warning. Now, this is another mark-it-up moment, you guys, if you're following along with this sentence. Hess's writings carried a warning that more than Jewish religious or national ideals awaited fulfillment in Palestine, but sheer physical existence also was at stake. Sheer physical existence was at stake. He's anticipating by 70 years something that would happen in 1938, right? Kristallnacht, 1938. The Nazi war against the Jews began. And there's a burning synagogue on Kristallnacht. And here is a Jewish shopkeeper starting to clean up the street. Kristallnacht means the night of broken glass, because the mobs would come through and break all the windows of the Jewish stores and then rob them and destroy them. And of course the Jews then had to clean everything up and had to pay for it and were fined as well. So this guy sensed the seriousness of anti-Semitism in Germany 70 years before it reached its peak in the Holocaust. Isn't that amazing? Sheer physical existence is at stake, he said. So he insisted that we will always remain strangers among the nations if we don't get our own national entity. All right, page 56 at the top, 1869. Now, during this period of time, doubts were accumulating in the Orthodox settlers' minds regarding the viability of the Chalukah system. the charity system. Men of unquestioned Orthodox persuasion began to see that the Chalukah charity system was detrimental both to reverence and to survival. It's just not going to last, you guys. So in 1869, the leader of the group, Joel Moish Solomon, and six of his friends bought a tract of land outside the city of Jerusalem. It was later entitled Nachlat Shiva, the plot of the seven, and the purchase represented Jerusalem Jewry's first voluntary, self-financed undertaking beyond the ancient Jewish quarter. So we were expanding outside of Jerusalem. All right, page 56, in the middle of the page there. Mikveh Yisrael founded, not mikvah. A mikvah is a tank in which you are immersed. Mikveh is a similar sounding word, but a little different meaning. Now, if you'll remember back to my remarks about Rabbi Kalischer, you'll recall that he advocated the establishment of an agricultural school in the land of Israel where Jews might learn farming and other practical subjects. Now, at Kalischer's initiative, the Alliance Israelite Universelle, a renowned French-Jewish philanthropy, provided the initial subsidy for a Jewish agricultural school in the Holy Land. This was established near Jaffa in 1870, and it was called Mikveh Yisrael, the Hope of Israel. And this school would have a lasting effect on the resettlement in the land. Now, Mikveh Yisrael still exists today. This little school now has a town built around it. And if you went there today, you would see the synagogue. This is the synagogue of Mikveh Yisrael. So it's still a thriving place even today. All right, so note this name, Mikveh Yisrael. It will crop up time and time again in our study. All right, 1874, we have the death of Zvi Hirsch Kalischer. Did I have a question? Yes. Yeah, it shouldn't be. It should be V-E-H, yes. Typo. Let's see. Typos don't count. I get 7,777 typos a year. I'm okay there. All right. 1874, Rabbi Kalischer died. And now we're at the bottom of page 56. The late 1870s and Chovevi Tzion. Chovevi Tzion. By the late 1870s, Zionist study circles and clubs had begun to function in the hundreds in Russia. Some called them parties or assemblies. A number adopted such names as Ezra or Maccabi. But generally, they were known as Chovevi Tzion, the lovers of Zion. Now, you'll also hear them referred to by the synonymous term Chibat Tzion, love of Zion. So these are essentially synonymous terms, but there is a distinction between them. Chibat Zion is the term that primarily identifies the ideology, the philosophy, while Chovevi Zion primarily identifies the people who held to that philosophy. The philosophy is the love of Zion, and those who loved Zion held to that philosophy. Now, their common ingredient was the acceptance of their credo. There is no salvation for the people of Israel unless they establish a government of their own in the land of Israel. Now, a few of these early groups simply offered courses in the Hebrew language and in history. Others established choirs or gymnastic and self-defense organizations. All these meetings were conducted secretly, for Zionism, like other varieties of minority nationalism, was quite illegal in Tsarist Russia. The Tsar did not like this kind of stuff. And at this time, there was no central direction, no organization to the Chovevi Tzion cause. All right, that brings us to 1874 and the Meah Shearim, and it's time for your break, so go ahead and take your break, and we'll pick it up in about 10 minutes or so with Meah Shearim. All right, let's pick it up at 1874 with Meah Shearim. 100 gates is purchased. Middle of page 57. This is the second Jewish quarter built outside the old city of Jerusalem, the second one. Nachlak Shiva was the first one. Mea Sha'arim, 100 gates, was the second one. And this is now inhabited by the ultra-Orthodox. It's an ultra-Orthodox enclave. So here's a map of modern Israel, modern city, or the modern Jerusalem. And you can see the old city here in this area, surrounded by, of course, all the new city streets. And just a little bit to the north and to the west is Mea Sha'arim, the ultra-Orthodox enclave. And it's well known for the signs that warn you when you come into the area, addressed to the ladies. To women and girls who pass through our neighborhood, we beg you with all our hearts, please do not pass through our neighborhood in immodest clothes. Modest clothes include closed blouse with long sleeves, long skirt, no trousers, no tight-fitting clothes. Please do not disturb the sanctity of our neighborhood and our way of life as Jews committed to God and to His Torah. So they take this very, very seriously. And they will confront ladies who they feel is immodest in their neighborhood. And here's a view of a section of Mea Sha'arim today, a very modern part of Jerusalem today. And here's another view of it. Mea Sha'arim, 100 gates. Again, an ultra-Orthodox enclave in Jerusalem. The second area outside the old city. Go ahead.
How many people live in there?
I don't know the population of Mea Sha'arim. Okay. All righty. 1878, Petach Tikva. In 1875, Joel Moish Solomon, the man who spearheaded the purchase of Nachlat Shiva, the plot of the seven, embarked on a quest for farmland. And the search took 3 years. In 1878, an available tract was located and purchased in the Sharon Valley, 6 miles from Jaffa. It was a wild and desolate stretch, lacking roads and lacking the assurance of Ottoman police protection. See, Israel was part of the Ottoman Empire at this time. Even so, the soil appeared fertile, and there was water available from the nearby Yarkon River. So mud huts were erected for 26 initial families. And Solomon and his company dubbed the settlement Petach Tikva, portal, or door of hope. Now, unfortunately, the river was not only the source of water, but also of mosquitoes. And during the project's first year, many of the farmers were struck down by malaria. Some died, others were deserted by their families. Until the first grain harvest, the survivors were continually racked by hunger and disease. And when the crops were reaped, they found no market among the Jews of Jerusalem, whose religious leaders were unforgiving of Solomon's heresy. Buying a plot of land outside Jerusalem for an independent settlement? Heresy. Yes. Question.
Just a question about the Hebrew part of it. If Mikvah Israel is home of Israel, and Petah Tikva is door of hope.
Yes.
Which word is hope?
In Petah Tikva, it's Tikva.
Tikva.
Yes.
And then in the other
Mikvah.
Mikvah.
So yes.
More than one word.
Yeah. Okay. Now, in the second year, the Yarkon River flooded, and the settlement was flooded out. And broken in body and spirit, the Jewish farmers abandoned their effort and returned to Jerusalem. And so Petach Tikva lapped into a wilderness. It would spring to life again in 1882, and it would continue. Here's a location of Petach Tikva on a modern map of Israel. And by 1912, it was a going concern. And that's the highest quality photograph I could find of Petach Tikva. And here it is today. Here's the great synagogue of Petach Tikva today. So Petach Tikva is a thriving city in modern Israel today. Judah Alkali died that year. And then in 1881, page 58, in the middle of the page, we come to one very important dude. This is a whole mark-it-up moment here, this whole section. Eliezer ben Yehuda arrives in Israel.
Huh?
Say again?
Should have a movie,
yeah. Yeah. Now, during the years prior to World War I, a crucial linguistic framework was being established for the Zionist redemptive effort. Now, while Hebrew studies did exist outside the land of Israel under the agency of the Chovevi Zion groups, they were virtually non-existent in the Holy Land itself. Until the later 1870s, the handful of Jewish schools operating in the land were almost entirely religious and conducted in the Yiddish language on antiquated Orthodox lines. So you see, these settlers, the initial settlers, came from Eastern Europe. They spoke Yiddish. They did things in the Orthodox way. So what did they know to do? They just continued doing what they knew how to do. The emergence of modern Hebrew, a language capable of secular vernacular use, awaited the heroic achievements of a sparrow-chested little Russian Jewish philologist, Eliezer Perelman. Now, philologist, the word philology means the study of languages, linguistics. So he was a language guy. He was better known by his adopted surname, Eliezer ben Yehuda. And here he is. This guy is a giant in regard to the creation of the modern state of Israel, because he brought back from the dead, basically, the Hebrew language, turned it into a modern language, Eliezer ben Yehuda. Now, he was born of Orthodox parents, and he received a religious education. Eliezer joined the thousands of his generation turning away from Orthodoxy, turning away from Pietism to Haskalah secularism. Now, the Haskalah movement was a Jewish philosophical movement in Europe that stressed secularism and assimilation. Don't worry about the religious rabbinic Judaism. Blend in with the country that you're part of. Well, that didn't satisfy Eliezer very much, and from Haskalah, Eliezer turned to Zionism. So he started in rabbinic Judaism, went to secularism, and then ended up in Zionism. His vision of language as the decisive component of a modern nationhood awaited his years as a student in the Sorbonne in France. There he became acutely conscious of the role of literature in the growth of French nationalism. He wrote his fiancée in 1880, "I have decided that in order to have our own land and political life, it is also necessary that we have a language to hold us together. That language is Hebrew, but not the Hebrew of the rabbis and the scholars. We must have a Hebrew language in which we can conduct the business of life." So in the next year, in 1881, Ben Yehuda, only 23 years old, married his fiancée, Deborah, Dvorah. She was only 27, and they departed for Israel. From the moment they boarded the ship, they vowed to speak no other language than Hebrew, and that pledge was never broken. Never broken. Now, the couple's years in Israel were poverty-stricken. In Jerusalem, Ben Yehuda earned a pittance teaching Hebrew for an alliance school. But his every free moment was devoted to editing a succession of Hebrew language newspapers. And here is the classic picture of Eliezer ben Yehuda at work with paper and pen. No computers, you guys. All handwritten. We have it easy, don't we? Yeah, it's a heroic effort. So he edited a succession of Hebrew language newspapers. In the 1880s, the circulation of the newspapers was barely 200. There were occasions where he and his family were evicted from their room for lack of rent money. At times, they nearly starved. Ben Yehuda did not make his situation any easier because he incessantly attacked the Orthodox. Remember, he was a secular guy. And he attacked the Orthodox. He constantly upbraided them for their opposition to, first of all, secular Hebrew, opposition to secular labor, and the fostering of the Chalukah, the charity community. He called Chalukah a social crime. That didn't go over well with the Orthodox at all. So the Orthodox retaliated by stoning his office and denouncing him to the Ottoman authorities as a traitor. He was once briefly jailed. They also placed him under the ban, rabbinical ban of excommunication. And then finally, when his wife died of tuberculosis in 1891, the Orthodox refused her burial in an Ashkenazi cemetery. Well, after Devorah died, he then married Devorah's sister Hemda. We do have some pictures of Eliezer and Hemda ben Yehuda. Here is one of the few pictures of them. Here's a portrait of Hemda ben Yehuda. And we also have a picture of Devorah and Eliezer's son. Devorah and Eliezer's son is Ben Zion ben Yehuda. He is the first modern Hebrew-speaking child. He was raised with modern Israeli Hebrew as his first language from day one. Day one. First modern Hebrew-speaking child. Question?
What is the difference between the rabbinic Judaism and modern Judaism, or Hebrew rather, and why would you have trouble doing business with the rabbinic Hebrew?
Okay. Classical Hebrew, biblical Hebrew, is much more complex than modern Israeli Hebrew. Now, if you know modern Israeli Hebrew, it's easy to pick up classical Hebrew. It's not the reverse. Like when I teach Hebrew, I teach modern Israeli Hebrew first, and then when people seem to have it, then I go to the hard stuff, which is biblical Hebrew. So it's a simplified version. And secondly, biblical Hebrew doesn't have the modern terminology. It doesn't have a word for automobile or university or telephone or anything like that. So you need a modernized secular language. And we'll see that in just a minute. Okay. Now, this retaliation by the Orthodox still goes on today, many, many years after Ben Yehuda's death. Now, the Israeli government considers Ben Yehuda's house an historic home, an historic spot. So they mark the house with a plaque. However, as soon as the government puts the plaque up, the Orthodox come and tear it down. Okay? And this putting up and tearing down goes on even today. When I first visited Israel, my first trip to Israel in 1994, Dr. Fruchtenbaum took us by Ben Yehuda's home. And there's the front door of the Ben Yehuda home. And guess what? Off on the right, that's where the plaque is supposed to be. We weren't there in time. We didn't get there in time. However, there is somebody that did get there in the millisecond between putting the plaque up and tearing it down, and there it is. That's the way it would look if you're fortunate to get there before the Orthodox get to it. They still hate Ben Yehuda. Quake, say again? They just destroy it. They just do their best to destroy it. The government keeps making new ones, yes. Yes. Oh, yeah, Ben Yehuda Street is a common name in Tel Aviv and in Jerusalem.
Is the house on Ben Yehuda Street?
No, I don't believe it's on Ben Yehuda Street, no. Okay, question.
Do the Orthodox Jews to this day still do not speak secular Hebrew?
Yes, very strict Orthodox Jews today speak Yiddish. They reserve Hebrew for the synagogue, for the Bible. It's the holy language. We don't want to desecrate it. Okay. Well, they usually speak Yiddish, you know. There's everybody in Israel is multilingual. Okay, one more question.
What about the Sephardi?
What about them? No, they speak Ladino.
So do they speak
yeah.
Ladino?
Yeah, yeah. If you're ultra Orthodox and you feel Hebrew is the holy language, not to be used in secular conversation, you speak German or French or Ladino or Yiddish or anything else. Yeah, yeah. All right, so this tearing down and putting up is still going on even today. Now, nevertheless, Ben Yehuda's work began to have its impact. Soon, all the agricultural colonies subscribed to his newspapers, and they purchased his textbooks. He became a power in the Yeshuv, and eventually in the Zionist world at large. By the turn of the century, he was well launched on the project that would absorb the remainder of his life the creation of a modern Hebrew dictionary. And there's a picture of him at work on the dictionary, no computer, pencil or paper and ink, working through tome after tome after tome. A lot more difficult than we have it today, right? A lot more difficult. It was a heroic effort, you guys. Page 60 then. Pursuing his research with books and other materials sent by disciples from Europe, he relentlessly tracked down the Semitic roots of words, and ultimately they were incorporated into the contemporary vernacular. In 1904, modestly endowed by a grant from Jewish sources, Ben Yehuda published the first volume of his dictionary. It was virtually an encyclopedia of the Hebrew language, a monumental work of scholarship. He would complete three more volumes before his death. After his death, afterward, the undertaking would be expanded by his successors into a 17-volume series. And you can still get it. There it is. Complete Dictionary of Ancient and Modern Hebrew by Eliezer Ben Yehuda on Amazon.com, a mere $850. I don't have it, no. No, I don't. I don't need it. And by the way, if you can't afford this one, you can get the pocket version. It's a lot cheaper. And also a lot less words in it as well. But yes, it is available today if you're so interested. Eliezer Ben Yehuda. Yeah, that's the whole thing. The whole Megillah. How many do you really need? The pocket version. Survival Hebrew. That's all you need. Okay. All right. So this dictionary became the definitive basis for the revived spoken and written language. This is the gold standard for modern Israeli Hebrew. Now, in putting Hebrew into vernacular use, Ben Yehuda counted heavily on the yeshuv's teachers. In the turn of the century, the largest number of these was employed by the, and this is German, you guys, so the Hilfsverein der Deutschen Juden, something along those lines. German Jews. Yeah, German Jews, something of German Jews, exactly. Hilfsverein, do you know that word at all, anybody? Ken? Where's Ken? Huh?
Hilfsverein.
Okay, well, I'll call it H. All right, I'll call it the H, because I've never taken any German. I don't know how to pronounce that. All right. Now, at the turn of the century, the largest number of these teachers was employed by the H. In 1914, the H operated a network of... What? I probably don't want to hear what that was, okay? It operated a network of 50 schools throughout the yeshuv, from kindergarten through secondary institutions. And they provided instruction for 7,000 children. Now, it was due mainly to Ben Yehuda's efforts that the Hilfsverein, something like that, laid renewed emphasis upon Hebrew studies. The Alliance schools, these are the French schools, the Alliance schools were conducting the major portion of their instruction in Hebrew, as were the schools of the Zionist agricultural colonies. Additionally, 60 Zionist schools in the towns and outlying farm communities, some 2,600 students were using Hebrew as their sole medium of instruction. Most of the Zionist farmers and workers accepted fully Ben Yehuda's contention that a nation was its language no less than its sweat and blood. Now, just before World War I, the directors of the Hilfsverein schools began offering a number of courses taught exclusively in German. The issue of German versus Hebrew became urgent, didn't become urgent until plans were laid to establish in Haifa a technical institute. Funds for Technion had been made available by the estate of Wolf Vysotsky, a Russian Jewish tea merchant. You know, if you go to Israel today, you still can get Vysotsky tea. Okay? Been there? You gotten Vysotsky tea? Yeah, there you go. Came from this guy. Wolf Vysotsky. There's some cherry tea, the big red W. And my wife likes it too. I like to bring it home. So he donated the money for the Technion. Now, the Jewish National Fund supplied the land in Haifa, but the Hilfsverein as the administrating agency. The Hilsveren was determined that the Technion should be the very capstone of the yeshuv's educational structure. Now, the German Jewish members of the Technion's Board of Governors proposed that all technical subjects be taught exclusively in German. See, German was recognized as the language of science. And Hebrew, in contrast, was deficient of a technical vocabulary. Now, this decision produced a wave of indignation among the Zionist settlers. And Ben Yehuda was infuriated. He warned the directors that blood will flow in the streets if you teach in German. Now, at Ben Yehuda's instigation, protest meetings were organized by Jewish students and teachers throughout the yeshuv. And in October 1913, the Hebrew Teachers Association proclaimed a strike at all the Hilsveren schools, and the students demonstrated outside the German consulate in Jerusalem. The Technion crisis seemingly threatened the entire Hebraic nature of the Zionist Renaissance. Aware of what was at stake, the Zionist organization immediately set about establishing more than a dozen new Hebrew language schools. However, 4 months later, February 1914, the language controversy ended when the Board of Governors reconsidered the matter and agreed that all Technion courses would be taught in Hebrew. And from then on, the commitment to a Hebrew vernacular for the yeshuv was never, ever in doubt. Now, by 1916, the fulfillment of Ben Yehuda's dream was in sight. A census that year indicated that 40% of the yeshuv's population spoke Hebrew as their first language. So the little philologist's accomplishment was formidable and widely recognized. When Ben Yehuda died in Jerusalem in December of 1922, 30,000 people escorted his body to the grave, and Israel's Jewry observed 3 days of official mourning. And here's a picture of his very humble grave. This man who was so much a part of creating modern Israeli Hebrew. And if you can read on the front stone, it says Eliezer Ben Yehuda. And basically it says he's the one who brought into existence Halashon HaIvrit, the Hebrew language, the Hebrew tongue. And the stones on the grave are a Jewish tradition. When you visit a grave, you leave a stone there as a reminder you were here. And it's not something that can blow away or disintegrate like flowers do. So that's why you'll see stones on Jewish graves. So he has a very humble grave. And if you want to read about him, here's the book all about him, The Tongue of the Prophets by Robert St. John, the fascinating biography of Eliezer Ben Yehuda, the father of modern Hebrew. So you see, this is my book. I scanned it in. You see, the cover's a bit beat up, but you can get it, I believe, at Amazon. Amazon has everything, don't they? So if you want to read about Eliezer Ben Yehuda in detail, there's the book to get, The Tongue of the Prophets. Question? Yeah, Technion is well respected, yes.
To invest in the upcoming business.
Oh, yeah.
Oh,
yeah, Technion is well respected. Yes, there was another question back here, just a second.
I just have a question about the language then, because they lack the technical vocabulary, how did they.
Eliezer Ben Yehuda created it. He did. He created it, yes. He rose to the challenge. Yeah, oh, yeah. In Hebrew, the vowels, if you aren't familiar with Hebrew, you'll see the vowels underneath the letters. Yeah, it's a vowel-less language, but vowels have been added by the Masoretes way back in the Middle Ages. Yeah, so if you see a newspaper without vowels, that's a newspaper for somebody fluent in Hebrew. You'll see other newspapers with the vowels for those of us who barely can manage. Yeah. Okay, let's go on. Okay, you guys. Okay, I got a lot to cover here. All righty, 1882. 1 year after Ben Yehuda and his wife arrived in Israel and began their early years of poverty, another significant Zionist appeared on the scene named Leo Pinsker. And here he is, Leon Pinsker, or Leo Pinsker. You have his picture on page 61. Now, Leon Pinsker was the son of an enlightened family in Odessa, Russia. Of course, it's called the Ukraine today, and there's Odessa on the Black Sea. So enlightened would mean secular family. Now, just to orient you to where exactly the Black Sea is and the Ukraine is, here's a Google Eye view. There's Turkey to the south, Romania and Bulgaria on the west, Russia and Georgia on the east, the Ukraine, the modern state of the Ukraine on the north, and of course Odessa there on the northern coast of the Black Sea. Very important city in Zionism. Because Odessa was the nerve center of mid-19th century Haskalah, the secular assimilationist movement. Now, in the 1860s, Pinsker's vision of the Jewish future was consistent with Haskalah. It was one of cultural self-expression within pluralist Russia. We'll assimilate into Russia. Jewishness is a culture. That was their point of view. However, in 1871, an anti-Jewish outbreak briefly exploded in Odessa. Deeply unsettled by the episode, Pinsker withdrew from all Jewish public activities for 7 years, and he brooded over the failure of this cherished idea of enlightenment. So Haskalah had failed him. Assimilation had failed. Eventually, he organized his views in writing, and he published a lengthy essay in 1882 entitled Auto-Emancipation. And yes, indeed, auto-emancipation is still available today. Auto-Emancipation, a call to his people by a Russian Jew, by Leo Pinsker. You can pick it up on Amazon in a number of different languages if you're interested in it. So all these writings, it's nice to have them still around. Now, in his work, Pinsker outlined his central idea. Normal dealings between peoples are founded on mutual respect, not on love. So it was unlikely that the Jews would ever be accorded such respect because they lacked the prerequisite of national equality. So he wrote, "The Jewish people have no fatherland of its own, no center of gravity, no government of its own, no official representation." All right, page 62. Rather, the Jews were perceived as a kind of a phantom people, bearing many of the characteristics of nationhood, but without the final indispensable ingredient of a land of their own. And again, using that metaphor of a phantom people, here's what he wrote. "There is something unnatural about a people without a territory, just as there is about a man, a phantom, without a shadow." There's his picture. Worse yet, as a phantom people, the Jews inspired fear among the non-Jewish majority. And whatever people feared, they hated. So this was his explanation of anti-Semitism. The solution then. The solution to the Jewish condition, Pinsker insisted, lay not in reliance upon the will-o'-the-wisp of emancipation, which had already failed, but in a concerted effort by the Jews to utilize their waning moment of opportunity to restore a national home of their own. And Pinsker attached no particular importance to the land of Israel. Here's what he wrote. "The piece of land might form a small territory in North America." Yeah, maybe in Southern California, who knows? Maybe in New York State, who knows, you know? "Or a sovereign pashalik in Asiatic Turkey." He didn't care. Just as long as we had nationhood in a land, any land. Didn't matter where. So until Pinsker, the vulnerability of Jews as a homeless people had never been demonstrated quite so systematically. For the first time, Jew hatred was analyzed as a deeply complex social phenomenon, bearing little relationship to education or progress in conventional terms. See, the problem here is that he was looking at the surface expression of anti-Semitism. He wasn't looking at the true root. And, of course, the true root is spiritual warfare. You know, the fulfillment of the Abrahamic and the land covenants. Satan striving desperately to save his career. But, of course, Pinsker didn't believe in anything like that. Now, almost immediately, auto-emancipation evoked a responsive chord among the readers. Very quickly, Pinsker became one of the most admired men in Russian Jewry. And for a while, he was the very heart of the young Zionist movement. In 1884, Pinsker set about organizing his nondescript collection of followers into a national movement. Who were his followers? His followers were that unorganized, unofficial, and illegal group of Zionist study circles known as the Chovevei Zion. Pinsker, by virtue of his prestige and by virtue of the general recognition that he was the natural leader of the growing Zionist movement, took the initiative. He would bring organization and focus. This is his contribution. He would bring organization and focus to the Chovevei Zion groups in 1884. All right. That takes care of our time for today. And we'll pick it up next week with the beginning of the first Aliyah. And that's on page, bottom of page 62. Bottom of the beginning of the first Aliyah. So let me go ahead and pray, and then I'll turn you loose. Father, again, thank you for this glimpse we have into the early stirrings of the Zionist movement. How you are stirring both religious and secular Jew alike. How you're bringing them together in connections, coincidental connections. No, connections fully orchestrated by your omnipotent hand. And slowly but surely, the Zionist movement is beginning to form in Russia and in Eastern Europe. So Lord, help us to see in our life that nothing happens by accident. It may look that way, just as it kind of looks here, unorganized and unknown and maybe illegal, but you are at work. You are at work putting things together, and you're at work in our life as well. So help us to remember that nothing is an accident, nothing is chance. You are the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords. You orchestrate all that happens in this world, and you do it for your glory and our good. So help us cling to that throughout our lives. And we lift ourselves up to you in Yeshua's name. Amen. All righty, we'll see you next week.